night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Back home from Washington, D.C., happy as a clam to be in the home studio. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, your home for a little something we call conversation radio. Easily obtainable at headonradionetwork.com by clicking the Listen Live button. Also available on a wide variety of internet streaming platforms, places like TuneIn Radio. And their TuneIn Radio app for smartphones like your Android device or your iPhone. Also the Stitcher Radio app. Websites like dar.fm and streama.com. Roku devices. The podcast address is at whiterosesociety.org under the subdomain for this program. And you can also get the podcast at iTunes. Yes? Yes? I believe the third switch is thrown. Sending? Yep. This is good. So, a bit of an announcement. It did not look, as of Thursday night, like we would finish, March to the good. But we did. We did, with a great deal of help from folks like Dr. Allen and Harry in Finland. And over the weekend, we got April. Well, we got a start on April, and yes, we did, in fact, beat the Swede. And the Swede is always happy to be beaten. It's a financial thing. Leave it at that. So we begin. Look, I've always thought practical jokes are a little bit on the mean side. And so, no, there's not going to be any April foolery on this Moran Monday edition of The Horn. However, there are a few things that one actually wishes were practical jokes or pranks, but unfortunately, ain't. It is Moran Monday on the Horn. By the way, I didn't mention it. You know, the PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. We begin tonight trying to raise $80. $80 to get us started in April correctly, because we've had help from, our buddy Horst and Randy in Pennsylvania to get the month off and running. So yeah, $80 is tonight's fundraising goal. Goody, that's out of the way. It is Moran Monday on the Horn. And, well, Moran Monday ranges from the sublimely stupid to the incredibly mean. Let's start with the funny. Or at least the mildly amusing.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. You know, morons.
That's right, it's Moran Monday on the horn. Hurry, hurry, hurry. Step right up, step right up. You will not believe your ears. Hiding behind this thin cybernetic veil of canvas are Morans, the likes of which beggar your imagination. Yes, indeed, yes, indeed. Step right up for the small, tiny, itsy-bitsy, minuscule, infinitesimal, nearly microscopic cost of less than 5 cents per hour of individual programming. This Moran Monday extravaganza can be yours. This is the only program you'll ever need to tell the Morans. You can't tell them much, but this program tries. No one will be admitted after the first 5 minutes. Head for the hills, or you'll be up to your armpits in Morans.
Oh, God, yes, God, yes, God, yes. Some might think that this is an Easter story, but Easter was yesterday, and it's not. No, this comes to us from our good buddy, Horst, who realizes we've never had a Moran Monday food porn segment. Well, we do now. Again, I want to reiterate, this is not an Easter thing. This is ever so much more than that. Easter did pass yesterday, and there's kind of a dovetail to this. It's a tale of several Morans, really. On the one hand, I was reminded earlier this evening by our buddy Dr. John under an email titled, "They Don't Call It Moran Monday for Nothing." Dr. John writes, "You're probably aware of this, but if not," and this is going to lead into the first ever Moran Monday food porn segment, "You're probably aware," you may ask how, but you'll see. "You're probably aware of this, but if not, the conservative shit hemorrhage over the Google Doodle on Sunday was stunning to behold. To summarize, Google, as it often does, replaced its search page logo with an illustration to commemorate an important anniversary. It's called a Google Doodle. You know, fireworks on the 4th of July, guy coming down a chimney or whatever at Christmas. Groundhog on February 2nd. We've seen him for years, right? But the right-wing morons have gotten to the point where they are offended by everything. Life itself, for all their vaunted celebration of the kitschier of life, offends them. History offends them. Culture offends them." So Dr. John continues, "Though it was Easter Sunday, Google decided to honor another important event. March 31st is Cesar Chavez Day." You remember Cesar Chavez? American labor leader? Yes. So the Google Doodle was a picture of Cesar Chavez, who was, as we in the Horn family commune all know, a pivotal figure in American labor history. He founded the precursor to the UFW and had the radical notion that migrant laborers deserve to be treated with dignity, or at the very least, a fair wage. Okay. "Conservo Twitter erupted," says Dr. John, "but it was the contours of the eruption that really struck me. First, they seem to have trouble distinguishing between Cesar Chavez and Hugo Chavez. So early Sunday, we got tons of tweets along the lines of, 'Why is Google honoring a dead socialist dictator?'" Oh, mother. Once people with enough brain cells to fill a Petri dish realized and reacted, the tone shifted to, "Well, they're both named Chavez, and they do look alike." You know, the right-wingers, they all look alike, right? Yeah. "Stop," says Dr. John. That's a good working of that definition of racism, ain't it? This from people who are trying to reach out to Hispanic and Latino voters? Yeah, them Chavez's. They don't look alike. Then we were treated to tweets about how un-American Google was acting. Stop again. Chavez was a U.S. citizen. In fact, he was against undocumented immigration for the very plain fact that undocumented workers depress wages, particularly for migrant laborers. These right-wing clowns claim to be against illegal immigration, too, but this is a pretty plain lift-the-veil moment that shows they're really against brown people, isn't it? Finally, with nothing left to grasp, the right-wing argument shifted to,
Google is maligning Christians because it chose to doodle Chavez rather than something about Easter.
Couple things here, Dr. John remarks. First, March 31st is Chavez Day every year. Easter floats. That means it takes a back seat in my book. Second, and can this be for the last time, please? Christians are the single most dominant group by identification in the U.S., so I'm sick of hearing how they don't get any respect. And third, is their faith so insecure that not having a Google Doodle equals persecution? Doesn't that actually demonstrate just how powerful they are? Well, yes, it does. This is me, not Dr. John. Yes, it does. But it also, as Dr. John notes, denotes how paranoid they are in their power. And I think we see that often coming from powerful groups who, in attempting to maintain their power structure, affect an attitude of constant persecution, of they're out to get us. Paranoia, in a word. Dr. John says, I was watching this unfold yesterday, shocked. It's almost beyond laughing at these people, but they seem to be so numerous, and they all have such big megaphones. And they do. They do. So you're wondering maybe, what's this got to do with food porn? Well, it does, in a Christian paranoia kind of way. So, Horst emails me this recipe. You may recall from time to time I say that something or another is enough to make me want to eat dirt and run rabbits. So this morning I see, Bob, you got the rabbits warmed up yet?
Tell me about the rabbits, Horst. Tell me about the rabbits.
I may need to borrow them here in a bit. They're always out there for you, Horst. Resurrection rolls are the perfect treat to make with your little ones to share the meaning of Easter. Remember, on Thursday, I think it was, we talked about the meaning of Easter, according to the late great prophet Bill Hicks, peace be upon him.
Mummy, last night, a goldfish left a Lincoln log in me sock drawer.
Yes, dear, and that's the story of Jesus.
Which reminds me, oh, God, several of you saw me, and I've just got to have some outlet because Agnes gets tired of, well, me just sitting around making half-strangled animal noises during television programs. I don't know why. I don't know how it happened. I got home from Washington, D.C. yesterday. Everything was going fine. When Ferg says, Dad, I've been watching the Bible on the History Channel, and I went, oh, no. Anything but that. No, but Samson was really cool. He was like this great big dreadlocked Rasta dude. I'm sure he was. At least he had a skin tone that more closely matched the people who lived there than their rock star slash, probably not the right word, Charles Manson guy did playing Jesus. Really, there were a couple of moments during the Passion where their Jesus looked a lot like Charles Manson. And my query was, You know, did they mean for him to look like Charles Manson, or does the goddess of irony just roll that way? So, there I was tweeting. And there was a lot to tweet about. And my head still hurts. That was bad enough. But then, yeah. Resurrection rolls are the perfect treat to make with your little ones to share the meaning of Easter. Resurrection rolls. You got that? Resurrection rolls. Little ones. So it's important that we tell the little ones about the gory, ahistorical murder tale of a Palestinian day laborer who just wanted people to be nicer to each other. Okay. Here's the recipe. You might want to, well, no.
1 can of crescent roll dough. 8 large marshmallows, or 1 for each roll you'll be making, melted butter, cinnamon sugar.
I'm trying to find this, trying to find the doctrine and dogma in this one. So far, no luck. Oh, keep reading. It's not every day that you get in a recipe an instruction to read the Bible while cooking. But lo and behold, you're supposed, at the same time that you're, you ever fooled with that crescent roll dough or any kind of pastry dough? It can be a sticky proposition. But apparently, you're supposed to look at your little ones and read them John chapter 19. Then Pilate therefore took Jesus and scourged him. And the soldiers platted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe and said, "Hail, King of the Jews!" And they smote him with their hands. Pilate therefore went forth again and saith unto them, "Behold, I bring him forth to you, that ye may know that I find no fault in him." Then came Jesus forth, wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said unto them, "Behold the man." When the chief priests, therefore, and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Pilate saith unto them, "Take ye him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." The Jews answered him, "We have a law, and by our law he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went again to the judgment hall, and saith unto Jesus, "Wherefore art thou?" But Jesus gave him, "Wherefore art thou?" is Romeo. "Whence art thou?" is Jesus. But Jesus gave him no answer. Then saith Pilate unto him, "Speakest thou not unto me? Knowest thou not that I have power to crucify thee, and have power to release thee?" And it goes on in what Chaucer would refer to, perhaps, in Swish Liqueur. How the hell did Chaucer come into this? Anyway, so you're supposed to read this to the little tykes. Because remember, we're using dough and marshmallows to teach people about, teach little people, little children. Thorns? Crown of thorns? But Mommy, that sounds mean.
Yes, it was. It's terribly mean.
And of course, John 19 is the one, is the chapter that has long gotten the Christian church into terrible, terrible trouble, because it pretty much lays it off on, well, yeah, the Jews.
Read John 19 while the oven is preheating to 350.
Yes. While the oven is preheating to 350 degrees Fahrenheit.
Unroll the crescent rolls and place on a rimmed baking sheet.
Rimmed.
lined with parchment paper, explained that this is like the cloth they wrapped Jesus in.
The parchment paper. And the dough.
Give your child a marshmallow.
This is where it starts getting really fun.
Give your child a marshmallow and explain that it represents Jesus. All white and pure. Because he was without sin.
Emphasis on the word white. Ain't going to use none of them toasted coconut brown marshmallows. No, by God, he was white. Just watch the History Channel series and you can find out. I practically looked like a surfer dude.
All white and pure. Roll the marshmallows in the melted oil butter, in the melted butter. This symbolizes the embalming oils.
Mommy, I don't want to eat the rolls if they're going to be like dead people. I remember Grandpa's funeral. He didn't look so good.
Roll the marshmallows in the cinnamon sugar. This is like the spices used to prepare his body for burial.
Well, I don't want to eat no more cinnamon, Mama, please. They use that on dead people? Really? Mommy, ooh, make it stop. I just want a cookie.
Wrap the marshmallow.
It's going to take a little work.
Wrap the marshmallows. Wrap the marshmallow in the crescent roll cloth, pinching the dough together securely. Pinching. This represents how they wrapped Jesus' body.
What, Mommy? It's going to be like eating Jesus' body? Mommy, that's kind of sick. Mommy, do you need to sit down for a little bit? Do you want me to bring you the little cocktail and the little pill that you have me bring you when you're having one of your sick headaches, Mommy?
Put the rolls in the oven, symbolizing the tomb, and bake for 12 minutes. The oven, you'll recall, is 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Nothing says Christian lovin' like putting the Savior in the oven. While the rolls are baking, read John 20, 1 through 18.
Now, little Leander, you just sit down right there. Mommy's going to read you John 20, 1 through 18. Little Leander, you quit that sniffling and snuffling and a-crying. This is all to teach you about your risen Savior.
Little Leander, don't make me get out the belt. You know where we was reading about how Jesus got scourged? Mommy can do some scourging too. You just quit that whining. John 20. The first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene.
The first day of the week cometh Mary Magdalene early. No, Leander. Early was not her last name. When it was yet dark, unto the hole in the rock, and seeth the stone taken away from the hole in the rock. Then she runneth, and cometh to Simon Peter, and to the other disciple whom Jesus loved, and saith unto them, they have taken away the Lord out of the out of the hole in the rock, and we not know where they have laid him. Peter therefore went forth, and that other disciple, and came to the
I wish they'd quit fooling around with this hole in the rock. So they ran both together, and the other disciple did outrun Peter and came first to the hole in the rock. And he, stooping down and looking in, saw the linen clothes a-lying. No, Leander, it doesn't mean that he was lying about seeing the linen clothes. You're not getting the lesson here. You're not going to get a little Jesus roll if you don't behave. Then comes Simon Peter, following him, and went into the sepulcher, and see if the linen clothes lie. Leander, I don't think you're taking the lesson seriously. And the napkin that was about his head... No, 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 little Leander. Not like the napkins we use at supper. No, Jesus' napkin didn't have no barbecue sauce stains on it. Not lying with the linen clothes. Yes, yes, at least the napkin could tell the truth. Leander! You're Mommy's trying here. So it goes on like that. And after 12 minutes, one for each disciple, open the tomb and remove the rolls. When they're cool enough to handle, because you don't want no hot Jesus, I'd say it's a test of faith. You know, I mean, they're at the room at Pentecost and everything. They told they'd take up serpents. If you can take up a daggum serpent and drink strychnine, surely to God you can pick up a 350-degree crescent roll. Open the tomb and remove the rolls. When they're cool enough to handle, break one open and discover what happened to the marshmallow. Jesus is risen. Happy Easter. Fundies. No, Jesus isn't risen. The pastry is. Jesus, the perfectly white and sinless marshmallow, has been incinerated past recognition. That's why it's gone. It's all burnt up. It's melted. It's gooey. It's run away. And by the way, if you do not pinch the cloth together real good, Jesus will make a sticky mess all over your good bacon sheet that's been rimmed. Not kidding. This just got liked all over the place. Break one open and discover what happened to the marshmallow. A minute ago, it was Jesus. You know, if it had been one of them brown, toasty coconut marshmallows, we could actually tell that there had been a marshmallow there. But since it's a pure, white, sinless marshmallow, there's no sign of it and no way to prove that the sinless white marshmallow ever even existed, which is basically the present status of Christianity. Now, again, I realize this is an Easter recipe. Me, I've never been real keen on marshmallows, except the toasted coconut ones. My father and I had, and he more than I, had a real passion for those. Oh, Jesus, I should never have said passion. Oh, probably shouldn't have said Jesus. See the trouble you get into here? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Michael writing in, April Fools? Bob, you promised you weren't going to do an April Fools prank. Shame on you. Michael, I wish it was. I so wish it was. You wonder why our children are as messed up as they are? You got Mommy out there making little Leander. Now, honey, you squeeze, and I helped squeeze the dough all around the Savior. You know, honey. We're all done now, and it's time to put the itinerant Jewish rabbi from 2,000 years ago in the oven. you believe this? Clueless Fundy lady has no... clue whatsoever that she is displaying a level of ignorance and just cultural idiocy of a really? She's gonna put the Jewish rabbi in the oven? I'm guessing there's no unit for the Holocaust in their homeschool in there, you know, right after the segment on how Hitler attacked the Alamo. The pure white Jesus. Jesus is risen. Jesus wept. But you see, you know, when we get to this part about putting the Jewish rabbi in the oven, you begin to understand that, yeah, there's a really, and the part in John and, you know, crucify him, cried the chief priests and the people, all that. There really is an ugly undercurrent of anti-Semitism that still runs through Christianity. Especially the Fundy kind. Roman Catholics will at least make some noises about not feeling so good about all them pogroms and holocausts and murders of, you know, the last couple of thousand years. But the Fundies are waiting for him to come back. Put the unbelievers to the sword. Gig 'em, said Jesus. Beggars the imagination. So we'll transition out of this and into some more stuff in a minute, but it really, this thing kind of does demand its own bumper, don't you think? Dr. John writing in, what is it with Christianity and cannibalism? Don't get me wrong, it's not an exclusive practice. See, for instance, the Barawan of Borneo, who allow their dead to decompose on the kitchen table and occasionally drink the fluids, mixed with mashed sweet taters. Sorry to anybody who's eating dinner. But come on, first transubstantiation and now baked Jesus treats? Yeah, but Dr. John, come on, think about it. How long until the Blessed Virgin appears on one of these Jesus rolls? There'll be lines around the block. Clayton, the militant sociologist, noting, really? Really, Bob? Oh, just give them honey buns. Here's a honey bun, Leander. Run along. Mommy is having one of her sick headaches. I need a Darvon and a tequila. We will. We really will. We'll transition away from this now. Thanks to Dr. John for the bumper.
Chocolate Jesus, keep me satisfied. pick me up. Better than a cup of gold. It's the only chocolate Jesus satisfies my
Tom Waits, Chocolate Jesus. I consider Tom Waits, well, I consider Tom Waits to be a kind of a prophet without portfolio, sort of like Bill Hicks was. All right, we got to get away from that. But I had to, I'm sorry, after last night's blockbuster ending of and all better now. All better now. Let's go from squirrely white folks making white marshmallow Jesus snacks to some other unhappy white folks. This thing was published in the Washington Post on the op-ed page. And the nomination here, by the way, is of the right-wing readers of the Washington Post. This piece was published in the Washington Post on March 29th. It's by Charlotte and Harriet Childress. And they, Charlotte, and I get their emails from time to time. They're co-authors of Clueless at the Top, while the rest of us turn elsewhere for life, liberty, and happiness. They write about outdated hierarchies in American culture. I'm guessing, based on the tenor of this thing, that they've got something valuable to say. But not according to the angry white folks. They write, imagine if African American men and boys were committing mass shootings month after month, year after year. Articles and interviews would flood the media, and we'd have political debates demanding that African Americans be held accountable. Wait a minute. Held accountable. Because that's what the for-profit media sounds like. They fancy themselves the voice of God. Then, if an atrocity such as the Newtown, Connecticut shootings took place and African-American male leaders held a news conference to offer solutions, their credibility would be questionable. The public would tell these leaders that they need to focus on problems in their own culture and communities. But when the criminals and leaders are white men, race and gender become the elephant in the room. Nearly all of the mass shootings in this country in recent years, not just Newtown, Aurora, Fort Hood, Tucson, and Columbine, have been committed by white men and boys.
Yet when the National Rifle Association, led by white men, held a news conference after the Newtown massacre to advise Americans on how to reduce gun violence, its leaders' opinions were widely discussed. Unlike other groups, white men are not used to being singled out. So we expect that many of them will protest it is unfair if we talk about them. White folks, unfairness. But our nation must correctly define their contribution to our problem of gun violence if it is to be solved. When white men try to divert attention from gun control by talking about mental health issues, many people buy into the idea that the United States has a national mental health problem, or flawed systems with which to address those problems, and they think that is what produces mass shootings. Here's the important part. Well, I mean, the whole thing's kind of important, but this is where they really drive the nail. Oh, bad analogy. But women and girls with mental health issues are not picking up semi-automatic weapons and shooting schoolchildren. And immigrants with mental health issues are not committing mass shootings in malls and movie theaters. Latinos with mental health issues are not continually killing groups of strangers. Each of us is programmed from childhood to believe that the top group of our hierarchies, and in the U.S. culture, that's white men, represents everyone. So it can feel awkward, even ridiculous, when we try to call attention to those people as a distinct group and hold them accountable. And this paragraph, too. I kind of wish Dr. Bill was available for comment on this paragraph. I think this would speak to him. For example, our schools teach American history as the history of everyone in this nation. But the stories we learn are predominantly about white men. To study the history of other groups, people have to take separate classes such as African American history, women's history, or Native American history. And if we take Hispanic American history, we don't expect to learn Asian American history because a class about anyone but white men is assumed not to be inclusive of anyone else. Wow. Such an assertion would seem obvious on its face. But it isn't. It's in the nature of privilege. I think Dr. John has remarked on this in the past. It's very subtle. But the authors continue, this societal and cultural programming makes it easy for conservative white male-led groups to convince the nation that an organization led by white men, such as the NRA or the Tea Party movement, someone's going to get angry, can represent the interests of the entire nation when, in fact, they predominantly represent only their own experiences and perspectives. Again with the obvious, but maybe to you, maybe to me, out in the world, Wonder Bread, not so much. If life were equitable, white male gun rights advocates would face some serious questions to assess their degree of credibility and objectivity. We would expect them to explain what facets of white male culture create so many mass shootings. Why are so many white men and boys producing and entertaining themselves with violent video games and other media? Why do white men buy, sell, and manufacture guns for profit, attend gun shows, and demonstrate for unrestricted gun access disproportionately more than people of other ethnicities or races? Why are white male congressmen leading the fight against gun control? If Americans ask the right questions on gun issues, we will get the right answers. These answers will encourage white men to examine their role in their own culture and to help other white men and boys become healthier and less violent. This thing hit the Washington Post and went nuts. Something like 5,000 comments. Guess where most of the comments came from? I mean, now, did you hear anything unreasonable in what was put forward. Because I didn't. You know, Plato said, or perhaps it's paraphrased, that the unexamined life is not worth living. Well, who wants to live a life that's not worth living? That means there must be constant examination and re-examination and re-re-examination. That life itself is a constant assessment both of where you're going, where you are, and where you hope to wind up. And none of those things remain static. But, of course, we know how the NRA responded. We know how the Tea Party, the Tea Baggers, responded.
Problems with the crazy people and them damn video games. What do you mean there's a problem with upstanding, God-fearing Christian Americans swapping of their guns at great big humongous gun shows? What do you mean there's a problem with straw man purchasers? That's the free market. Invented by white folks, thank you very much.
These women are right. We should be demanding serious self-examination among white men. But they don't. Let's see here. Gotta find a dandy. Well, it just keeps on going and going and going. I had a couple highlighted, and I can't find them now. What it boils down to is,
there's lots of dark-skinned people that commits gun violence, too. Most gun violence committed by dark-skinned people. Why aren't we axing them?
Completely oblivious to the obvious fact that most of the mass shootings, your Columbines, your Littletons, your Newtowns, are committed by white people. But they're terrified. Your average white winger. And they are terrified to the point of being able and willing to kill as a result of their fear and paranoia. By the way, I guess prosecutors have asked for the death penalty for the white man in Colorado who shot up the movie theater. Now, in that instance, I'm not a death penalty proponent. Never have been, never will. But there is nothing in the nature of mass killings that suggests executing one mass killer is going to stop the next. And if deterrence is not the goal of capital punishment, then should we just admit that it's an act of pure vengeance and get on with it? Because that's what it is. On the other hand, speaking of violent white folks, a lot of us have followed what has become an ongoing story about the murders in Texas and Colorado. A prisons official in Colorado gunned down. An assistant prosecutor in Texas gunned down. And most recently, a prosecutor and his wife in Kaufman County, Texas, gunned down. Guess who? According to the Denver Post, Evan Ebel, E-B-E-L, got the gun that he used to commit the murder he committed via something called a straw man purchaser. That is, in essence, a purchaser who is a phony purchaser for someone in the background. The killer, Tom Clements in Colorado, had a felony rap for his membership in the Aryan Brotherhood, obviously a white supremacist gang. He couldn't go and buy a gun, so he got somebody to do it for him. And he did so. Stevie Marie Vigil, 22 years old, female, went to the upstanding, God-fearing, law-abiding gun shop, High Plains Arms, so she could get Ebel what he wanted. Sailed right through. And then he went and killed Colorado Bureau of Prisons head Tom Clements, because the Aryan Brotherhood wanted to see him dead. Because the Aryan Brotherhood is, in many instances, a prison gang. And they operate in prisons all over the country. We should probably devote a little bit of time to the gang culture. There's a specific story I'm thinking about. To the gang culture in the American prison system, in which membership is compulsory. High Plains Arms on Broadway in Englewood, Colorado, sold Stevie Marie Vigil a 9mm Smith & Wesson handgun that was, you must remember, that was manufactured for the purposes of defending freedom and protecting it. Except in this case when it didn't. So, in turn, although they're not saying... Well, they're saying less about it than they would like, or than most folks would like, and being kind of tight-lipped about it. Some law enforcement officials are now noting, and yes, I know some law enforcement officials smacks of the Fox News style book, but it's what I got to work with. Kaufman County, Texas, March 30th. Mike and Cynthia McClelland were murdered in their homes. Previously, Mark Hasse, H-A-S-S-E, from the same district attorney's office, had been murdered. Now, of all the silliness you could possibly imagine that would contribute nothing to the discussion, naturally, Candy Crowley. Remember Candy Crowley from last week's, week before last, Moran Monday? Candy Crowley, who worried about the lives of the poor little rapist boys in Steubenville, Ohio? Well, she had just enough time after the story of the murders in Kaufman County broke to get Lindsey Graham Cracker on the program, and she said, "Just off the top, let me ask you, when we see the death of the head of a prison official, two deaths of a DA and an assistant DA, this is a dangerous business. I know prosecuting bad guys, incarcerating bad guys. Do you think we need to look at the protection of these people?" To which, and I presume an echo came with it because he's, you know, so deep in the closet, Lindsey Graham Cracker replied, "Well, anything that would make our law enforcement officers safer, obviously, yes. Anything the local community can do to make life safer for those who carry out the law on our behalf, count me in. There's clearly some kind of criminal vendetta against people who enforce the law." Thank you for that trenchant observation, Lindsay. You'll notice the use of the word "anything the local community can do to make life safer." Anything. Anything. You mean maybe like eliminating straw man purchasers at gun shows where it's literally the Wild West once you pay your admission fee? Well, not that thing. No. I mean, she passed the background check. For heaven's sakes. I think I'm going to faint, you talking about laws limiting our ability to protect our freedom. Mercy sakes, I'm going to have the vapors. Yeah. So, that. White folks with guns. I'm sure that if you asked in a column in the Washington Post why it is that most members of the Aryan Brotherhood are white folks, their response would be, "Well, there's Latino and African-American gangs, too. Why are you focusing on the white peoples?" Sheesh. And then this, because it is Moran Monday, and, well, nothing says Moran like Cardinal Timothy Dolan. I guess it's just a segue because we were talking about Lindsey Graham a minute ago. Timothy Dolan showed up on ABC's This Week with George Snuffleupagus. Now, the question was as follows. And, you know, especially this week, because it's been at the top of the news, for many gay and lesbian Americans, gay and lesbian Catholics, they feel unwelcome in the church. And what do you say as a minister, as a pastor? Oh, can we please quit pretending that Timothy Dolan is a minister or a pastor? He's a freaking, he's an executive of a corporation. He's management. What do you say as a minister and a pastor to a gay couple that comes to you and say, we love God, we love the church, but we also love each other, and we want to raise a family in faith? What do you say to them? To which Cardinal Timothy Dolan, for whom irony is apparently, it's what happens to his little white dresses every week when the lady takes care of the laundry. That's irony. Not too much starch in the irony. Timothy Dolan responded, well, the first thing I'd say to them is, I love you too, and God loves you, and you're made in God's image and likeness, and we want your happiness. You bet they want their happiness. They want it to keep it for themselves and to take it from gay folks. But, and you're entitled to friendship. Really, that's a quote. And we want your happiness, but you're entitled to friendship. But we also know that God has told us, really, voices in our heads, huh? God has told us that the way to happiness, that especially when it comes to sexual love, and you know how much about that, Timothy Dolan, unless you're due for an indictment soon, that is intended only for a man and woman in marriage, where children can come about naturally. Come about. Hard about. To starboard, even. We gotta do better to see that our defense of marriage is not reduced to an attack on gay people. And I admit we haven't been too good at that. So, Timothy Dolan is saying that gay folks, as far as the Catholic Church are concerned, are free to be friends. 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 Remember Jonathan Winters. Remember his friends. You're free to be friends. No love. No love. You can be friends. But none of this modern secular friends with benefits business. Be friends. You know, that's also what we call it when Father Fingerbottom has the little 8-year-old over for catechism lessons. And the 8-year-old walks home a little funny. Friends. 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 Feel free to be friendly as you want. Just don't be loving like, you know, Jesus done said. Right? This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. We'll be back.
I don't speak right. All right. But yet I know what I'm talking about.
I can't be prepared. I can't be prepared. I can't be prepared. I can't be prepared.
I know you're waking for the CIA. They wouldn't have you in the pipeline.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
About 9 minutes past the hour on this Moran Monday edition of The Horn, I'm Bob Kincaid. As noted, awfully nice to be home for a week. Program note. Home for a week. Then back to Washington, D.C. Then home. And a PRISM West Virginia American History Chat coming a week from this Saturday. Okay? Awesome. Hope you'll join us. I hope you're tuning in to Dr. Bill O'Brien, or at least getting the podcast or grabbing his show file out of the Dropbox. The discussions on Federalist Number 10 have been nothing short of mind-blowing. I know several members of the Horn family who have begun listening to Dr. Bill could attest to what I say. I mean, it's easy for us to say, well, you know, the government's this way because, and somehow or another wind up repeating a bunch of not correct stuff that's been passed down one way or another. You want to know how America got to be America? Check out Dr. Bill O'Brien, Monday through Wednesday, 4 to 6 p.m., immediately before the show. Sal noting, by the way, Bob, your voice is way too deep to imitate Lindsey Graham without a falsetto. Ain't even gonna try, Sal. No, 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 no. So with the understanding we do have more nominees, let us go immediately to the phones. The phone line is open. The filibuster is over. 304-658-3333 is the number. If you wish to join in via Skype, you can always reach the program at Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn, Bob Kincaid Horn. If we are not friended up as contacts yet, shoot me a contact request and I'll okay it and we'll get you on the air. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob.
Hey, what's happening?
Not much, just made it back home in one piece.
I saw, Tracy, I saw your Facebook comment. Thanks for the kind words.
Oh, hey, well, you know, I mean, like I said, I just can't. It's just so beautiful. And, you know, just to say, as I'm writing on Yahoo about them considering that, you know, we don't need civil rights. Or affirmative action and stuff like that because it's outdated.
Don't need it no more.
Don't need it no more. We're colorblind here.
Yeah, the equality just busting out all over.
You know, like spring, it's busting out all over. So as such is equality. Yeah, not so much. Like I said, you know, I walk over to the elevator. White woman standing there, she sees me and walks up the stairs. Not that I care. I'm like, hey, you know, more room for my ass, you know?
Hey, she might be packing heat. I'd have rather had that ride by myself, too.
Well, you see, that's the thing. You know, being raised in California, well, Los Angeles, I have a whole different perspective on racism because it's so covert here that, you know, somebody smiling in your face and you think they're
it's not, you know, just straight up where you are.
No. It is not. It's those little things like, you know, being passed up for promotions or, you know, saying that you shouldn't not, you know, you're not up to par when you're in a honors English class and, you know, those little things like that.
Right.
You know, it's not like where my mom lives with her Confederate flag, you know, waving from the flagpole.
At least you know where you stand.
Right. See, that's what my mom said, because my mom was born and raised here also. So she had to get schooled on where she could and could not go. And she's like, well, you know, the one good thing about living in the South as a black person, you know where you stand. There's no ands, ifs, or buts about it. It is what it is. And so, I, you know, there was a reckoning for me the first time I went down south as an adult when I was confronted with, Billy Bob Joe and his buddies as they pull up at the gas station and they're, you know, the 4x4 with the big old Confederate flag on the hood of the truck.
Heritage.
You know, and I'm walking out of the gas station, and they're looking at me like, bitch, where you going? I'm like, I'm just, and I'm about to ready to, you know, to jump. You know, you're feeling froggy, just come on, leave then. But then my mom, who has been now indoctrinated in the ways of the South, is watching this whole thing go down, and she's out of her car in the flash like, come on, let's go. You know, because I'm not one to back down, but then again, I was in Oklahoma City, so there's that. And so I have, you know, I these are the things that I'm not used to. These are the things that you read about, right? And I'm, like I said, I'm used to institutionalized, you know, racism, but that right in your face, slap you right there. It's like, wow, wow, you know, but all in all, I had such a wonderful time, Bob. It was just...
Well, when last we talked, you were contemplating low country cooking. Did you get some?
I went to the Hominy Grill.
All right.
And it was actually right around the corner from the hotel that I was staying at, in Charleston. So I had the shrimp and grits.
Wasn't that something?
And, oh, my Lord. You know, Bob, let me tell you a little something about me. Now, I pride myself on my grits. I don't make instant grits because my folks are from the South, and I think my grandmother and all those before her will rise up and beat the hell out of me if instant grits, even if I looked at them in the store, okay? But the grits down in South Carolina is a whole different breed of grits.
Well, I can tell you, I know, I can tell you where to get them.
I bought some, you know, I bought some, man.
Oh, did you get some to take back with you?
Oh, I bought that, I bought some red rice, I bought yellow, honey, let me tell you. My poor suit, now here's the funny part. When we came out there to Atlanta, my girl, because my brother's from here, and he was crying because there's no good deli, of course. In Atlanta, how could there be?
I know. What do you mean? There's a huge Jewish population in Atlanta. There's great deli.
According to my brother, not.
I know. Well, yeah. unless it's gone under, I know where it is.
Okay, well, let me know, because let me tell you, we passed him up We went to the one of the best U.S. delis here in L.A., packed them up 2 pounds of pastrami, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And then we bought him some, you know, fresh-baked rye bread and bagels, the whole shebang. And we put it on ice and packed it my carry-on. So we, you know, we checked that. Bob, let me tell you something. My brother, we went to the Hawks game that night when I got there. He's like, I know you got food in here for me. He was making a sandwich.
Yeah.
In the parking lot.
Well, hopefully you brought the good rye bread and you brought the mustard. And.
Well, yeah, we brought everything. As a matter of fact, they had baked that rye bread. So I think a little tear welled up in his eyes. But I'm telling you, I have, you know, the shrimp and grits in South Carolina, in Savannah. I had the low country boil, which was shrimp, corn on the cob,
mm-hmm.
potatoes, red rice.
Now we talked. Now, was red rice amazing?
Oh! Another thing that almost brought tears to my eyes. I just, glory to God, Bob, I understand why you can't leave. And I understand why you also contemplate leaving. I mean, I don't have it on the same level as you.
Yeah, I am deeply conflicted, let's put it that way.
I can understand. And I can understand my brother and sister and my mom leaving L.A. and coming there because of the way black folks live. But conversely, I've never seen black folks live so well and then black folks live so poorly. Because I saw some folks as I was, especially in, not so much in Charleston, but in Savannah and Chattanooga, I was like, whoa, you know.
Oh, and you didn't even get to Mississippi.
No. No, that's the next trip. That's the next trip because we want to hit Biloxi and Louisiana and all that. But there's a sadness in those people's eyes, Bob. It's just, and especially the older, you know, like I wrote in my little essay, my little travelogue, there's a sadness there of time, you know, because like my sister-in-law, both my sister-in-law and brother-in-law are Southerners, born and raised in Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
And they're both in their early 30s. And they were still, schools were still segregated. They were still going to segregated schools as late as in the 80s and the 90s. And that just perplexes me. It just really, I mean, to the point where my sister-in-law's mother will not go anywhere where there's too many white folks. She's like, aren't there a lot of, you know, where we talking about where I was going? They're like, aren't there a lot of white people there? Aren't you, you know, and I'm like, really? Do you still feel that way? Wow. I was doing a lot of wow moments. Especially poor Jan, who really had her indoctrination into slavery was basically Ruth and the Happy Negroes of on those plantation movies like Gone with the Wind and, you know, all that. So she, we walking through the slave markets and stuff like that. And she's like, was it really that bad? I said, sweetie, has anybody asked you if the Holocaust was really that bad?
Ooh.
I'm just.
How'd that go over?
She's like, okay, I get it. I'm like, yeah.
Because that's one of the things. Tracy, we talk about slavery and we say, slavery.
Slavery.
Slavery was a Holocaust.
It was a Holocaust. It was a Holocaust. And when
from the Middle Passage, you know, from what happened on the African continent to the Middle Passage to here to the slave markets to the plantation, Holocaust.
Holocaust. We went to Chattanooga. We went to the African American Museum there. And they had this film. You could see in different parts or watch the whole thing. The first part of the film was African civilization and African peoples and whatnot and so forth. And then it went into the slave trade.
So I had her and my nieces watch the first part, talking about the great African civilization and how thousands of years before white people were still, in the dark ages and stuff like that, Africans had, commerce and trade and civilizations and all this, even though we were deemed, once, white people came to Africa, or Europeans rather, we were deemed savages. So I had her and my nieces watch that part, right? And then we skipped to the part with slavery, and it was talking about the conditions on the floor. Because, see, the pictures that show the slaves, cat tight right next to each other. But what you fail to realize from the pictures is that not only were they packed tightly next to each other like sardines, they were packed on top of each other also.
Yeah.
As rows and rows.
Right,
and
as if maybe, or comparable with a few centuries later, human beings being crammed into boxcars so that they could not move.
Exactly. And so, where are you going to go to the bathroom? What are you going to do? And so, yes.
Well, that's it, there's so many things that go into it. You make sure that you never put two people who speak the same language next to each other.
Exactly.
And so with all of that, what you've begun is the essential process of dehumanization. It was a shock therapy of its sort.
It was.
Can I share something with you?
Sure.
So I was in D.C. last week, right?
Right.
And on Saturday, we got most of our cleaning up done and decided we would just relax, and then we'd hit the road on Sunday morning and have a much easier trip of it.
I was praying that you guys went on that highway with that horrible accident.
No, awful. Fancy cap. Yeah. So on Saturday, Bo looked at me and said, you know what I got a hankering for? I said, what's that? He says, I want a really good hot dog.
Okay.
And, there's dirty water dog stands all over D.C. during tourist season. But that wasn't, I said, if you want a hot dog in D.C., there is one place that defines hot dogs in D.C. And it's up on U Street. And it's in the heart of what used to be a very self-reliant, very segregated African-American community. And so we got on the metro and we rode up and got off the U Street stop. And we went to Ben's Chili Bowl. And the line was out the door, into the building, and back up a separate line. And then back down a third line to place your order. That's how busy this place stays. It was opened in 1958 in an old vaudeville theater by a couple of color, Ben and Virginia Ali. And 10 years after they opened, after Dr. King was murdered, that whole area
burned.
Yeah. And Ben's Chili Bowl became the place where the peace was negotiated. So
Okay. It
has its own separate history. But during the Civil War, that area of what is now D.C. was basically just open land. And so the Union Army put up a huge, huge field hospital. You know, those accounts of Walt Whitman where he writes about his experience as being a nurse to the wounded Union soldiers. For all I know, they took place up there.
Right there. Okay.
And so because it was such a huge Union encampment, when slaves ran away to freedom, especially after the Emancipation Proclamation, they went there. And after the war, they kind of naturally settled there and began to build this high-functioning, magnificent culture within a culture.
Like Rosewood?
Yeah, yeah. Certain parts of Pittsburgh. And that was back, that was kind of back when, I guess you'd say, Booker T. Washington's theory was in the ascendant.
Work hard, you know.
And someday, work hard, prove yourself, and someday they'll let us assimilate.
They'll let us, maybe, possibly. Okay.
Right. So, but all these things, there's always an epiphany because, you know, especially when I walk around D.C., I try to walk with my eyes absolutely peeled open to the history and the sort of cultural vibe of the place. And not too awful far from the metro stop is the African American Civil War Monument.
Awesome.
And I was bowled over. There's a bronze statue of, on the front that you see when you walk up to it, of three African-American soldiers in uniform. And you walk around to the back, and there's another African-American soldier guarding or standing next to a woman with a baby at her breast. And I teared up. I don't know what that makes me, but I teared up.
It makes you human and it makes you proud.
Because here's the other thing. Way down there on the National Mall, you know, the place where we put the monuments that really mean something to the country.
Yes.
Okay. There is a black granite wall with 55,000 names on it of our war dead from Vietnam.
Right. And that was a big hoop brouhaha because of the Asian that designed it, yes?
Right. But on that wall are the names of black folks and white folks and every kind of folks, you know, except Bush yeah. folks and Cheney folks and
right.
And whose bodies were offered up to that horrible, horrible disaster. And I'm not taking anything away from that memorial by saying what I'm about to say. Meanwhile, you got to go way the hell and gone up to U Street. And remember, the streets are named A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Yeah. How far you got to go to get to U?
Okay. Almost at the, it's like the last, next to the third to the last letter of the alphabet or it's the fourth, whatever.
U, V, W, X, W. Yeah, about the 20th letter. But you go up there and see what I'm getting at here is at the African American Civil War Monument stands that bronze statue. To get to it, and I think I noticed these things, Tracy, because
you're you.
No, well my initial training was as I was a child growing up. My big sister, who is 15 years older than me, was studying art in college.
Okay.
And I always envied her because I can't draw a stick figure without screwing it up.
No, I can't even draw a straight line with a ruler by.
Yeah, okay, so we're there.
We're there.
But she instilled that or somehow, you know, osmosis or whatever, I got some of that sensibility. And when I wound up in college, I studied creative writing of poetry.
Okay.
And so to get to the African American Civil War Monument, I had to walk across this granite paved small plaza that had an entrance to the metro station in it. So when you pop up out of the metro, you know, you see this monument. And I suddenly realized I was walking on glass. And as far as I was concerned, this is hallowed ground. And I'll get to why. And I realized I was walking on glass, and I looked down, and there, shattered all around on this granite pavement, into a million tiny pieces. And I knew it was this because I saw the remnants of the label was a shattered bottle of Old English 800. And that took me aback.
Uh-huh.
Because it, I don't know. It's like peeing on a church.
Right. It's just.
This is a sacred place to the extent that a secular society can set one aside. And then this is the finishing touch to all this, Tracy. There were two semicircular, sort of U-shaped rows of shining stainless steel plaques that surrounded this bronze statue. And you had to get right up on top of it. But then you realized, and I later did a little research to find out what was going on. Inscribed on those stainless steel plaques that hopefully will last a millennium were the names of 250,000.
What?
Freed black men and slaves who had run away who became veterans of the Union Army in the cause of freedom.
See, you know, I got a story for you. When we went to visit my mom in Fayetteville, we went to the Special Ops Museum. I'm loving history and stuff. And my mom was saying, because it's not that old, I don't think it, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and she was saying how there was a huge uproar when they opened the museum because there was not one depiction of African Americans during, in special ops and stuff like that. So, of course, they rectified the situation and put in, what would they call it, Ten Pennies? Oh, Jesus. I can't think of what the regiment was called. But I was talking to a brother there, and we were, I said, isn't that funny? We get this one little section, and I said, I know there were black people that fought and served in special ops and whatnot and so forth and, blah, blah, blah. And just so happened, he was there with his grandfather, who was a Buffalo soldier, Bob. He served in World War II as a radio operator. And man, I talked with him for a while, and I asked, do you know these things where I kick myself when I don't record these conversations? But
yeah.
He's telling me about how, what it was like for black soldiers, during World War II and the training, and the segregation. I can read about it all day long, Bob. I can watch, Red Tails and Tuskegee Airmen and all these movies and, and all of that. But to actually talk to somebody that was there.
Yeah.
That could tell me about how, what he went through during basic training and all this. And here he is, a black man serving a country, fighting for freedom, because he was talking about how he went to France and how he was treated differently there than he, and how he witnessed, German POWs being treated better than him. And I'm just like, again, the more things change, the more they stay the same,
Right, and as I stood there looking at those 250,000 names, Tracy.
250,000. Wow.
The first thing I thought of was, old Marse Robert Lee must have thought it right unsporting to let the niggers be fighting them, because they've done running out of white folks.
Exactly.
But when you see that number, 250,000 men of color under the colors in uniform, that was going to be a stomping. And that probably, and I mention all this because, you were talking about your experience in the South. There's stuff that people don't forget, whether they know they've forgotten it or knew they ever knew it. But, the next time I hear
some dumbass say, oh, the Civil War was not about slavery. The Civil War was about the economic inequities between the South and the North.
I'm going to say, dumbass, get you bus ticket to U Street in Washington, D.C., and go and tell that to 250,000 inscribed names of people who, A, put their lives on the line, run away from old Mars.
Exactly.
And then got to freedom and said freedom wasn't enough. They's going to turn around and fight for it.
And fight for it so that the rest of their family and their kin and all of this can have the same kind of freedom, too.
The Civil War was not about slavery.
It just, you know, it's like, so basically, you know, we're already planning our next trip, Bob, okay? So our next trip is going to be called the Civil Rights Trail.
So you will be going to Selma?
Yes.
Okay.
So the trip was going to consist of back to Atlanta, of course, because we're picking up my sister-in-law. Because I drugged her. She's like, when we went to the Jimmy Carter Museum, Bob, she's like, that's here. I'm like, oh. But you know what? She thanked me. Because I drugged her there. And then when we came back and we went to Chattanooga, I drugged her and my brother and my nieces to, you know, the African American Museum. And, you know, and I sat them down. They're like.
You had to drag. You what?
No, I didn't have to drag them. No. Let me rephrase. Did not have to drag them. But it's these things that they wouldn't have done other than because I'm here. That I was
right
there. You know? And so, you know, like I told you about the film and the map of all of the African slave trade and stuff. And I pointed them out about the Golden Triangle from, you know, Africa to America, America to Europe and, you know, and I talked to show, because of course they don't go into all that. It was a brief overview, but I also talked about, you know, I showed them Africans going to the Caribbean where they were, quote, like how you were saying, the indoctrination and the brainwashing and all that. Then they would, after they, you know, those that survived were sent to the Caribbean for seasoning. So they can really, you know, and that's where the horror began, you know, because people are under the misconception, as myself included, that, you know, slaves came directly from Africa to the United States, and that's not so. They were from Africa to the Caribbean and the Caribbean to so they could be ready for the, you know, the brutality of working, you know, in the low country and sugar cane and all that, so forth and so on. So after, you know, watching my brother and sister-in-law in utter amazement about, you know, slavery and the slave trade, because I said after, after the transatlantic slave trade was stopped, you know, that did not end slavery in the United States. The only thing it did was made it sure that, you know, they just started breeding us because, you know, we were animals. So when they were, like, going, wow, I'm like, okay. So our next trip, we'll be going from Atlanta to back to Chattanooga, Memphis, Nashville, Selma, and Birmingham.
That'll be a year from now, right?
Maybe, or it might be sooner. Why?
Well, as you get closer, because see, there is once you get over into Mississippi.
Summer.
Once you get over to Mississippi.
Mm-hmm.
There is an honest-to-goodness civil rights trail.
Really?
I mean, it literally will take you by the place where I mean, it'll very realistically lay out to you everywhere that everything that happened to Emmett Till happened.
Really?
Yeah.
Well,
Texas Betsy wants to know if she can come along.
Sure. I am ready to do this. Because after I said Memphis, and I said, okay, so you know what happened in Memphis, right? And I got a silence and this, you know, deer cotton head, like, look, I said, Lorraine Motel, anybody? Bueller? They're like, no. And I said, oh, yeah, yeah. And so I just told my brother and my sister-in-law, okay, get out your iPhones and Google the Lorraine Motel. And they're like,
yeah.
And then they looked at me, they're like, oh, we're... I mean, I can't be mad.
Auntie Tracy's making us learn history again.
It's like, I can't be mad completely.
No, it's not anger. It's frustration and a certain degree of sadness because, you know, not learning history is how history stops being history and starts being something that got forgotten.
Right. And like I wrote, so what did you think of my little expose?
Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
My mother wrote to me and she said, okay, will you just go ahead and start teaching? Just go back to school. Get your degree and just teach. And I'm like, no. I don't want. I mean,
no, you just be a missionary.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that would be my better calling is just to go out and speak and just say, you know, what I know and make people. I have Jan is now like totally, she's like, okay, I need to get some books and stuff like that. I'm like, uh-huh. Like I said, slavery was not, you know, Mammy and what was her name? And
I was thinking of Butterfly McQueen, but
yeah, Butterfly McQueen, her character. I don't know nothing about Boston, baby.
Now, did you ever notice that Mammy is the smartest human being in the entire freaking movie?
In the entire movie.
Yeah.
You know, and so I.
I just wanted to tell you, when you go to Selma, because I had this experience last year, they've got something there called the Museum of African American Enslavement.
Oh, wow.
And it is fully interactive.
Like the Holocaust Museum out here.
Haven't been there, but. Fully interactive in that you, the minute you go through the door, the minute before you go through the door, you start getting the slave experience.
And this is in Selma, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
How far is Selma from Birmingham?
It's a right good ways yet. You got to go down to Montgomery and turn right.
That's at Albuquerque?
Basically. But you know, what you're doing is you're going down into the heart of the Black Belt, and the Black Belt has nothing to do with race.
Being black.
It has to do with the geography and the soil. It's geographically fascinating because what it is it's a short grass prairie.
Okay.
And the soil when people the soil is literally, well, you know, before the cotton planters burned it all up.
Right.
Black. I mean, jet black. It was rich. Rich the way that Midwestern prairie soils were rich.
Until.
And so, let's plant lots of cotton on this.
Yeah, let's just destroy the
land.
But
the, you know, there's so much of. If you remember a while back we talked about Charles C. Mann's 1493?
Right.
He goes into great detail about you know, why slavery, and talks about the process of what was referred to generally as seasoning.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that white folks could not survive, generally speaking, a year of living in this new land because they were being killed by mosquitoes.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, right.
Exactly. And yellow fever. But anyway, to stand in Selma, Alabama in July, and, you know, I know it gets warm in Southern California, Tracy.
It's a whole different kind of
This is a whole different kind of hot.
I'm telling you. I've been in the South, and that's why.
You feel like an anvil, and the sun is a hammer.
Mm-hmm.
But again, just because of the way my mind works, to stand there and try to imagine 12, 14 hours in that sun,
picking
chopping cotton.
with the thorns in your fingers and the heat beating down on you, and just the overseer.
And not too far from there, and the site, I discussed this some with Dr. John, and I think I mentioned it in the abortive filibobster of June the 29th, right before the derecho knocked us out. But to stand in that heat and to realize what all is around you, and to know that down there in Selma, they are still trying to, the local government is still trying to use public lands to put up a monument to the father of the Klan, Nathan Bedford Forrest. You know, among other things, you cross over the Alabama River, and right there at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge is the American Voting Rights Museum. And across the street from that is a memorial to Bloody Sunday.
Exactly.
And you will not be okay.
No. And this is one of those reasons.
And they put a billboard, and I imagine it's still there, because somebody done went and stole the bust of General Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Oh.
Okay. So they've got a big picture of Nathan Bedford Forrest on a billboard sitting right above the Voting Rights Museum. Offering a reward for the return of the done stole statue bust of General Nathan Bedford Forrest.
Well, and again, you know, and then we go back to what I said earlier about, you know, saying that civil rights is, you know, that our country is now colorblind and we don't need, protections under the law.
Bull.
It just boggles the mind. And this is one of the reasons why I have been, after getting my nieces were glued to this, to that presentation. Because they're just old enough, one is 9 and the other is 7. To kind of get it, especially the 9-year-old, she'll be 10 in a couple of months, but she's very intense. And they're both very intelligent young ladies. I really enjoyed spending time with them. And they were looking at me like, give me more. Auntie, you know, give me more. And so this is why, because it's my duty, is it not?
I'd say it is.
As somebody who loves them and somebody, so they won't grow up thinking, you know, that, and asking, you know, and somebody asking, was slavery really that bad, Auntie? Honey, yes. Well, you know, so when they grow up and when they turn 18, they will be running to the polls.
If you take them through that Museum of African American Enslavement, they will never ask that question again.
Right, and that's why I want to take Jen. Actually, I want to take as many people as I can take. I really want to go in the summer only because I have more time off in the summer than. But I got to drop about 30 pounds before I could deal with summer in your part of the world, because Mississippi heat is a whole different heat in Alabama heat. I remember the first time. I mean, I used to go down south when I was a kid, but when you're a kid, you don't pay attention to the heat because you're a kid. You're just outside doing whatever kids do.
Yeah.
You know,
and somebody's always got a pitcher of Kool-Aid waiting.
Right. As you get older and their hormones start to shift, and as my mom and I now call it, I'm walking around having my own personal summer. You gotta take all these things into consideration. And I remember the first time I hit the southern heat and understood what that was all about. It was Florida in the summer, and I really wanted to kill somebody.
That's part of why Florida has the problems Florida has.
You know, I have never in my life taken as many showers as I took in one day. Because as soon as you get out the shower, you start to sweat. And it just, everything sticks to you, and there's a certain kind of funk that just won't go away. And it's like, oh, no, this is just not the picture. I don't like this. But then again, like I said, I really want to spend this, my time with, you know, this is what I'm embarking on. It's going to take at least 2 weeks.
Well, I got to tell you, you just got a note in from Kate.
Mm-hmm.
Who at present is up in Montana, but has been all over, you know, that neck of the woods. And under the subject line geography lesson, Kate says, Tracy, I'm so proud of you that you're working so hard to broaden your relative's perspective. Without knowing where we come from, we don't have a good road map for where we're heading. Bless you, sister. You will, however, she says, be disappointed when you get to Mississippi and Alabama. The poverty down there is bone-crushing, and Kate is not kidding. I see it as nothing but genocide still going on. She says, I appreciate your postcards from the road. I've been to most of those places. The heat down there will take care of those 30 pounds, believe you me. Looking forward to your next trip. Keep shining the light and keep the rock rolling.
Oh, thank you, Kate. Thank you. Yeah, and that's the thing. It is, last time I went to Louisiana, I was a kid, you know, and I was staying at my great great grandparents' place. And they were weren't well to do, but considering what I know now about the poverty in that part of the country, they were doing pretty damn good, you know. And I was looking at these black people, you know, standing in front of these beautiful $2 million homes, you know. And like I said, I've seen poverty in L.A. Of course I have. I lived it, you know. I grew up, we were so broke. My stepfather used to work at a grocery store, and he would bring home the cans without labels. I got so good at shaking a can.
And figuring out what was inside?
Yes. I can tell you if it was dog food, if it was clean peaches, if it was peas.
Canned corn.
I could shake that can, Bob, and tell you what it was. He would bring home loose grapes, you know, and broken bags of rice and stuff. But the thing is, even though we were broke and we were poor, at least we had access to things, to food and stuff like that. We could, you know, he had a job. It wasn't a good job, but, I mean, it was a job. I see these people when I was walking around Savannah and, well, not, like I said, not so much in Charleston, but in Savannah, Bob, and I'm looking at my folk and I'm like, oh, my God. These people... It hurt my heart because, like I said, I see it every day here, but it's different because there's resources here. You know, if you know where to go, you can get the kind of help that most people need. But there, I don't see that.
What Kate says is very, very well taken, Tracy, because it is an ongoing genocide. I mean, look at, I mentioned Charles C. Mann a couple of minutes ago. He makes the flat out statement that persons of color in this country have more a right to claim being American, quote unquote, than any white folks, because persons of color built this place. They built the roads. They built the systems. People say, oh, Thomas Jefferson built Monticello. My ass.
My Aunt Fanny.
Yeah. George Washington built Mount Vernon, please.
My Aunt. Man, he was out getting.
James Madison built, oh, God, what was the name of his home? James Monroe built Ashlawn. No, they didn't. No, they didn't. They never lifted a brick. I walk past the Capitol of the United States every day when I'm up in D.C. And see, because of the way I am, I can't look at the Capitol without realizing black folks built that.
Built it.
Part of the reason you see this desperation on the part of terrified white people is that I think they probably know better than anybody else where they stand? Because you know, you combine that with the shifting demographic, and you realize, you know, and nobody realizes like white wingers what's going to happen in about 30 years. And you realize that, you know, it's taken 400 years for the people who built this country to take possession of it. But it is going to happen.
No matter what they do, no matter how much gerrymandering, no matter how many laws they pass, no matter what they do. It's like I was telling Jan, you know, when we were, I feel like I'm Madam History when it comes to her. I was talking about the Asians. In the railroad.
Sure.
You know, and I said.
And then and then in the mix of all of this is, of course, the people who were here first.
Yeah, lest we forget.
Right. And one of the things I was going to tell you about that area near Selma, that short grass prairie. Somewhere down there. What should be the most famous battle ever fought on this continent took place, and it was called the Battle of Malbela, but nobody knows where the site was. But
wow.
That was the moment when the last great chance to run grabbing, greedy, grasping Spaniards out of the southeast went away. And that was when the great chief Tuscaloosa, for whom we named Tuscaloosa, gathered together all of his warriors in what he hoped would be an ambush of the DeSoto expedition. And he beat them up real good, but didn't finish them off.
Mm.
And everything changes from the Battle of Malbela forward. But you know, that's the other enduring theory that I have, and I've espoused it on this program a few times. When a place is absolutely sloppy sodden with human blood, the way that the American Southeast is, from the very beginning,
from the Jump Street,
then you got to wonder if it's ever got a chance at justice or equality. Because remember, you know, a state like Alabama is still largely owned by corporate interests. You can drive for miles upon miles upon miles and never see anything but timberlands that are owned by paper companies. You get around Birmingham, guess what you're going to find? Find you some coal mines.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and on and on and on. You know, massive fields of soybeans, corporate interests, growing genetically modified Monsanto soybeans. And I think, so, you know, as such, I think Kate's probably right.
It's just, well, I look at, you know, growing up, you know, back in the day, watching those cowboy Indian movies,
mm-hmm.
thinking, wow, Indians were horrible. Look at them killing up all those white poor whites. They just wanted, you know, to settle land and stuff like that, not knowing.
Well, you know, it's kind of like that story that I saw before I left D.C. that just blew me away. It was in New York City. Probably blew me away is not the right phrase. Even though I like to think I'm all jaded and stuff, I'm not as jaded as I probably think I am. Because when I saw when I saw this story saying that a young girl, and we're talking about a young girl who was told, give me just a second here. I want to get the quote right because it is such a sickening story. You know about the stop and frisk policy in New York City, of course.
Yeah.
Disproportionately, almost exclusively affects people of color.
to a level.
Make the stand your ground stuff in Florida.
Well, that, but in New York, you know, you've got a better chance as a person of color of being stopped and frisked than you do, there it is. Yeah. New York Police Department officer told innocent 13-year-old girl, stop crying like a little girl while he was groping her down in a stop and frisk.
A 13-year-old.
Yeah, I'm sorry. It's a 13-year-old boy.
And stop crying. And I'm being frisked in public, I would say, in front of all these people.
Yeah, Devin Almanor was in handcuffs at 13 years old when Officer
Crumpke?
When Officer Brian Dennis taunted him, telling him, stop crying like a little girl.
No, Bob, we don't need protection under the law, Bob.
He was stopped and frisked for jaywalking.
Jaywalking! Oh, somebody. So he's now public enemy number one.
Yeah.
And don't people jaywalk all up and down the street in New York all day long?
I can't speak to New York because I haven't been there, but I have darn sure seen my fair share of jaywalking in Washington, D.C.
I've been in New York. I ain't never seen it. Nothing like they jaywalk in New York, ever.
Like it's a sport?
It's a sport. It's the sport of kings in New York. It's like, you know, between dodging taxis and all this, and getting across the street, come on. So he not wrote him up for a jaywalking ticket or anything like
handcuffed him and frisked him.
For jaywalking. He didn't pickpocket anybody. He didn't shoplift or anything. None of that.
No, sorry, none of that.
Okay. He didn't hold anybody up.
Nope. Did he jaywalk.
Have a hoodie? Did he have on a hoodie and some Skittles?
Yeah, that part I don't know.
You know, because that's what Trayvon Martin was guilty of having, was wearing a
right.
hoodie and having some Skittles. So, you know, maybe he thought he was another Trayvon Martin. At least he didn't shoot. At least he's still alive to tell the tale. And that's a sad thing that I could say something like that, because he shouldn't have to have gone through that. They wouldn't have given some little white boy walking across the street from one of those, you know, uppity white schools up in upper New York or whatever, on the east side, west side, whatever. Wouldn't have happened. And had they been jaywalking, now would they? No. So, there again, nothing has changed. And when they say that we live in now and live just because we have a black president, because Jan said something, she's like, well, things are good. I said, sweetie, here, sit down and let Dr. Tracy give you a lesson on why things have not changed. If not, they have gotten worse because white folks have lost their minds because they're like, oh no, there's a Negro in the White House. Oh my God, what's next? A woman? But I said, if this man is the president of the United States, and I forget which one of the senators stood up and screamed out while he was addressing the Congress, you lie.
Yeah, and I'm just being told in the chat room by Sparky Tracy that our buddy Sergi there in the Fort Worth Metroplex area got pulled over the other night for driving a moped while black.
There again. It's,
well, you know, I mean, you never know when the next wave of terrorists is going to come to American shores and
get a
moped.
Well, it's like my son, who, you know, I'm pretty sure if you guys see anybody see my Facebook page, they've seen pictures of me and him. He's very fair. You know, I said fair skin. Oh my God, no, I did not say fair skin. He's light-complected. And so we live in Sherman Oaks, and he's like, now he would be walking home from work in his work uniform, Bob, work uniform. Big old thing, this big old shirt that says Humphrey Yogurt, okay? Yogurt place over by my house.
Mm-hmm.
And he would get stopped on a regular basis. Because he was, you know, he's a black kid walking. And then finally he told me a few years ago after, you know, that he had been put in the back of the handcuffed and put in the back of the police car. Of course, he never told me about it because he knew I would be at the police station that next day, you know, ready to rip somebody apart. But he's like, it would be the same cop, like looking at him like, what are you doing here? I live here. This is my neighborhood. I'm coming home from work. I'm an honor student. And all this, you know, with a 3.9 GPA. But they don't see that. They only see a young black man and, oh, God, what could he be doing? You know, and like I told
you. And, you know, the success of that level of white racism, Tracy, is in the fact that a police department like the LAPD got lots of Asians, got lots of Hispanics, got black folks, got white folks. But the dominant theory of scary black people promulgated by white people has effectively been filtered into the entirety of the institution.
Entirety. So no matter where he goes, you know, because Jan, I was saying, you know, I don't ever want to see him in a hoodie. And Jan's like, why? And I said, and then that's again, I have to sit her down and explain to her about the hoodie and the.
You may not believe this, but I'm wearing one right now.
But see, but you're not a young black man, Bob.
No, I'm not.
And you can walk around the hoodie.
No, it gets looks in D.C.
It gets looks. Have you seen that Volkswagen commercial?
I was, I was invited to come to a meeting at the homeless shelter about how to make my life better. Somewhat pudgy, pale white dude with white hair and a beard, wearing a hoodie, walking on Capitol Hill.
Well, there you go. Well, you know, but I was, there's this heavy, it's a Volkswagen commercial, and this guy walks into a convenience store. He has on the, you know, the ski mask, right?
Oh, yeah. And, yeah, I did see that the other day. For a minute there, I thought it was funny, and then I realized it wasn't.
No, because it wasn't. And that's that fear, you know. That's that underlying, that's that propaganda that, you know, you automatically, you got on the ski mask. You're here to do harm, you know. And it's just, again, it's just, you. We could talk all day. And like I wrote on my brother's Facebook page, I said, look at the wax now philosophical and shit like that. You know, we can wax on and that about the things, how things are changing and, you know, and things are never going to change and stuff like that. But then you see, because we have that fear about things ever changing when we see commercials like that, you know. And I think it's in poor taste, personally. That's just me, because of what somebody walking into a store with a ski mask means.
Right. I got that the first time. I thought, hey, that's funny. Oh, wait, it's not funny.
It's not funny. Because I was like you. I'm like, oh, that's. Fuck me, no. Because it's adding to the fear. It's those little things. You know, those little things like, you know, the stop and frisk laws and the stand your ground laws. These aren't little things. But it's, you know, why is the man that killed Trayvon Martin, why he is not in this jail, why is it taking so long? Well, because of his rights and this and that and that. But what about Trayvon Martin's rights? What about his rights? What about Emmett Till's rights? It's when I'm watching those, you know, again, those old movies, like when I was, you know, The Kill a Mockingbird. And, you know, when it came to Southern justice and you had a black man on trial and it's like a jury of his peers. Really? I don't see nobody look like him on that jury.
Mm-mm. No.
So how are you a jury of my peers?
Well, and that's what jury decisions of the fairly modern Supreme Court are all about. But that irritates white folks. Hey, Tracy, I got to roll. Looks like you've got the conversation going because we've got a bunch of lights lit up.
Awesome. Well, I'm going to go in the house anyway because my phone has been blowing up because there's a certain someone wondering where I am. But I'm at home, so I'll just walk in and pretend like I didn't know that the phone was ringing.
No worries, Tracy. Good to hear from you. Glad you're home safe and sound.
Always, Bob. Take care, and God bless you and keep you.
Thank you. Bye now.
All right, bye.
Tracy calling from home in Southern California. It's kind of nice to get the affirmation about what it must mean to be conflicted about the South. I genuinely appreciate that. Hey, a little update. We are $60 away now. No, $50. $50. Nap on the fly. My failing. $50 away from meeting tonight's fundraising goal. PayPal buttons at headonradionetwork.com. And we go onward. Hey, welcome to the program. Hello? Oh, I hear me. Hello? Hello? All right, we will put that line back on hold and try this one. Hey, welcome to the program.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening, sir.
What's happening, Bill?
Well, it was a good evening until you picked up the phone and got me, huh?
No, now it's gotten better.
Oh, buddy. What?
It's gotten better now.
Well, that's good. I just got home. I didn't know if you were alive or Memorex. Tracy was right on the money on this one. It's just the same old, you know. No matter what you do, you keep coming back. The dice keep coming up the same, you know.
Yeah, but they're not loaded.
No. Well, I got rid of everything I had in my life that used to go boom. I didn't need it anymore. I had one thing that was a piece of mechanical. It looked like it was stamped out by a machine, but it was interesting. It fired two 400 shotgun shells, you know,
mm-hmm.
or 245s in a Derringer setup. Don't need them anymore. The music critics aren't that harsh about me anymore, so, you know. Just stop being mad at him. How did it go down in D.C.?
It was busy, and we got a bunch of meetings set up for when we go back, so.
Do you think you can really do anything with these creeps?
Yeah, I think we are.
I hope to God you are about it. I hope.
Well, I'm not. Yeah. Bill, I'm not doing it for my health.
No, but it has to be done. I mean, I can't believe what's going on with these young kids down there. But honest to God, here I go again. I've used the term twice. Honest to whatever the hell they call it. You don't know which way to jump with this stuff because they're destroying. Your state, your area of life has taken a beating since day one. Since Washington was out there surveying the valley to see what he could steal.
Yeah.
And you would know more about me as to why the changeover in 1860s to an independent state. Was that for a really good reason, or was it just power and access to the money?
I don't know if power and access to the money are separate things, Bill.
Well, no, exactly. You're right. And I put them together because not one leads to the other. And that's what lights these guys up to take power. You probably know more about the statehood of West Virginia than I do because they cover it very, very light in war history. It was like five guys decided they wanted to stay with the Union. And why did they decide to stay with the Union? They loved the Union suit? Or was it by taking control of the state, they became the controllers of the cash and power? You know, as we said. What's your story?
Right, and that's some of the stuff that Dr. Bill was talking about with Federalist 10.
earlier this evening. It's worth going back and checking out.
How do I catch up to him?
Is his feed not up on White Rose yet? I thought it was, but.
What do I have to do to reach him?
If you want to call in, it's the same number.
Yeah. Well, but when I want to hear replays of what he had.
Well, he replays on my on this same stream, overnight and all the next day.
Okay, what time does he come on?
You'll just have to. It's my replay and his replay.
Okay, back to back. You come on around what, midnight replaying?
Yeah, somewhere about though there. Yeah.
Okay, it'll be about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Thereabouts, yeah. Or maybe,
that'll work.
Well, yeah, I'd say about 2, probably.
Well, that beats the hell out of listening to the Truck Drivers Network.
Oh, I would have to agree. But he was talking about that exact issue of what does it mean, Madison, asking the question, what does it mean, for there to be, majority rule? What does that entail, based on the human propensity for breaking down into factions.
Yeah. And the idea of majority rules does not only sit well with me if the majority is wearing, brown and black shirts and et cetera.
Right.
Doesn't sit well at all. But he gets into areas where I feel like a moron. I don't feel that stupid. I just started the book on Roosevelt's, the one that one of your listeners provided me with the name. The WPA book.
Uh-huh.
God, you get into that and you start hearing names and things called out that I've seen that are still in existence. Boy, it's just, we have a guy, there's a station down here on Akron there. They want an ex-pro football player who, when I knew him, was working with the battered women's shelter in Lake County, helping raise money for them, because at that time the woman I was married to was running the shelter. And this guy, the only two words he can say are three, is get more guns. One of those people.
Yeah.
This guy scared me to death. And I was carrying long before they were. Back in 80 when my marriage broke up and I was living God knows where and what part of the city and traveling at all hours of the day or night, you might as well put a sign on your back and say, here I am, rob me. I was one of my, I was talking to a friend of ours, that one of my buddies who happened to be darker skin than me. He always said the only reason they'll rob you first, Bill, is they think you got 2 more bucks than I got. If they come up flat with you, I'm next, is the way he put it. They don't get enough out of you, then I'm next. But, the problem is they're broke, and I know they're broke. And, it's not my fault. I'm as broke as they are. I don't know if I'll talk to you about the county next to ours. The one that goes out towards PA.
Mm-hmm.
The name Lake is associated with it. Bob, there's more smack out there than I care to admit. And I saw this stuff in the 60s. I was in a room with a buddy of mine, and he borrowed my belt. And he says, hey, you want to try this? No, thank you. I'm screwed up enough now. I'll just let it go of that, I didn't kind of. Because there's things happening that are worse than they were years ago. And you guys are active in a real important function. It's so hard to believe that this pollution is spreading this fast. And down around Akron, Ohio and such, they talk up that idea of selling your land to the frackers. They're pushing it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
people are buyers.
And now, but now it turns out. Did you see the story about Arkansas and the nasty tar sand spill?
No.
Oh yeah, a tar sands pipeline ruptured in Arkansas. A neighborhood was evacuated. There was literally oil coming out of the ground. And people who lived in the neighborhood said, you know, we've been here 20 years. Nobody ever told us there was a nasty oil pipeline under our homes.
Nope. Nothing is said. It's all about the cash. And what have I missed today in the national headlines? What have they failed to vote on today?
Well, they're not in session this week.
Okay.
That's why I'm home this week.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know. I presume that you know that legislative titan from Alaska, Don Young.
Yeah.
Yeah. He recently hauled out a nasty old racial epithet. And refuses to apologize for using it.
Oh.
Yeah. He was called on the carpet for referring to people as wetbacks.
Oh, wonderful.
And he said, well, I know this term is not used in the same way nowadays, and I meant no disrespect.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it okay if I
refer to him as a scum-sucking pustule on the backside of humanity, as long as I mean no disrespect?
Well, I'll tell you, I know people who've gone up there to live, and they come back to visit us here in the lower. You wonder, did I really know this person? They were living down here when they were born and raised down here, because their attitudes have changed so much. It's like they're living on the frontier, and look out, those Russians are going to come pouring over the border.
Right.
Well, if they do, my friend, you're a deep doo-doo. If they really did, because, you know.
I had the story earlier today about that Dr. John shared with us, all about how the right wing had hissy over the Google Doodle this weekend, featuring Cesar Chavez Day, and the outrage that the white wing manifested. And lo and behold, and this the Don Young story is actually a couple of days prior to that. So you've got Don Young using the term wetback, refusing to apologize for it, and then. And then 2 days later, white wingers objecting to a marking of the day of Cesar Chavez's birth. How much has changed, Bill?
Not much. Not much. If ever. I mean, what are they going to do as the population? I mean, I'll be long gone before the population is out of the grasp of the majority race. But it's going to happen. And maybe in a way I'll be happy to be gone, because maybe there are members of the other group that will say, hey, it's payback time, idiot.
Well, see,
judging on what was done, I wouldn't want to be in the way of somebody who's got a payback attitude. Because he'd look at me and say, yeah, you're one of them, so, you know. Because that's human nature sometimes with some people.
But see, the United States is not very good with dealing with coming problems. The majority of the 19th century shows that. The run-up to the civil rights era shows that.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, if we were serious about the United States continuing to be a viable nation, we'd get busy on the demographic issue a generation ago. But we're not.
Yeah.
The people with power are still desperately trying to cling to power. as the people without it try desperately to claw it back, to claw it away.
Well, you know, I talked to friends of mine who have a little darker complexion than I did, and of course, some of them are astounded that a guy my age was, well, when you grew up in a housing project like our buddy Rick Smith, and he was on the west side of Cleveland, but I was on the other side, so we saw things differently a lot sooner than other people did, and met people a lot sooner than other people did, and got along with people a lot sooner than other people did, and accepted people. How did they treat me? Treated me good. They didn't give me a bunch of crap, and they're fine people. And then a guy punched you in the mouth. He punches you in the mouth, and you're not too happy with him. But a guy who comes up and, hell, I was telling this buddy of ours that in the 50s, we were within walking distance of the old Cleveland Arena. When the National League was six teams large. And we saw some guys playing American Hockey League hockey. We were hot stuff. And then the league, the Crusaders, were in. I saw Gordie Howe play for Texas or the Houston with his kids. So that's not too bad a thing. But, and we were mixed, nice integrated groups of Americans playing street hockey back in the 50s, which was highly unusual for non-money-motivated kids. And in a way, I'm just delighted that I got a shot at learning what people were by being around people. But these folks today, they just can't, they'll never buy the change. Thank God I won't be around to see the, it could be rough. I feel like your kids, that age group of kids, it could have a tough situation going there. I don't know what your opinion is, because you deal with some big, you're standing up there with these big situations, and me, all I can do is observe the little stuff, you know? Day in and day out, mano a mano kind of stuff. I had a very good health aide who was taking good care of me until I found out she was stealing everything that wasn't nailed down. So you get mad about that, and then the people said, well, the way they set these social programs up in this country, there's a good story for somebody to check into, because they're just half-assed setups. What they do is they set up a bunch of small companies for people to get into and pick up a buck. It seems to be the Republican way of doing things. Set up all these medium-sized companies, and instead of the government running this system where the employees are answerable to somebody, they just skate along. I had dinner with a buddy of mine, his girlfriend, had surgery in a hospital around here 2 years ago where she got a new set of lungs, Bob. How's that sound?
Wow.
Yeah. And that was 2 years ago. He just stopped by, and we went out and had a bite to eat and picked up a few things. And he's been, these kind of things you never hear about. But we have the money to do all these kind of things if we weren't spending it on stealing oil from overseas and fighting wars in Afghanistan. And what have you got out of Afghanistan lately, Bob?
Not much. Not much at all, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Well, we got a lot of stuff in the 60s. It came in little blocks. Yeah, tar-like substance. And it fit nicely into a small pipe.
Absolutely.
That way, yes.
Well, I remember during the heady days of the early parts of the Bush War in Afghanistan, it got to the point, one of the reasons that we cozied up to the Taliban back before September 11th, 2001, was that while they were a bunch of fundamentalist weirdos, they also had gone in and rather effectively largely eradicated poppy production. Shortly after we began the Bush War against Afghanistan, however, the warlords got back into power, and of course their natural revenue source is
grow and sell it.
Yeah. And it got to the point where Afghan heroin was reaching the streets of New York with actual trademarks, branding on the bricks.
Oh, my God. You know what I was talking about when I was talking about that? I was talking about hashish.
Sure, I know.
Yeah. Because, man, me and Smack, I was afraid of that stuff. There's a radio station down here now that I was listening to them. They were playing an old version of a thing called Careless Love, which country bands also cover a lot, the older ones. The New Orleans guys really covered it and made me think about that. Well, you've read Hammett, and you know how drugs pop up all over that stuff. Written about the early 1900s and published in the early 1920s. What else is new, you know?
Sure.
It's a control factor. Well, I won't keep somebody else off because I'm not to, you know me, I can't get into something that maybe just happened today because evidently nothing did. Now, I used to listen to a lot of standard left-wing talk before I dialed into you, and I had a concept due to some of the guys as to what was going on. They talked about the biggest time stuff, whereas you were covering some of the most human-oriented stuff, like your kids having to carry water in school. How long are they going to continue? And I talked to people that live, a woman I know lives in a county or two away where her backyard is a big arsenal out there. And I forget the name of the damn place. The arsenal's been there since World War One. And she needed money. She gave them the option to root around in her backyard. And you try to explain to somebody what they just did. But they needed money so badly that they cut the deal. And they don't know what they're doing. They just think it's a business deal.
And, you know, the same thing applies to fracking, tar sands, mountaintop removal.
Now, all of them. You were talking tonight about the stuff erupting out of the ground with a broken pipeline?
Well, Arkansas.
Oh, my God. How long ago was that pipeline put in?
It's apparently been there quite some time. I don't know how long it's been moving tar sands. Sludge.
They can open up a new feeder and feed tar sands into it. And to me, maybe I'm crazy, but this tar sands makes it sound like it's getting harder and more difficult to get oil.
Well, and that's because it is. That's because of things like peak oil.
Yeah.
You know, the peak oil theory, Bill, says that as a resource becomes harder to get, more will be tolerated in terms of how you go about getting it. And once you've peaked at peak oil, it gets harder and harder and harder to get. There was never any... See, I remember the oil shale business in Colorado, the, what, 80s, late 70s?
Yep.
But it really was. At this point in time, though, the only reason they're willing to go after the tar sands in Alberta is because it is economically viable. And it's only economically viable if they get that godforsaken pipeline.
Yeah. And the pipeline is dangerous to all of us who it flows under or near.
It's dangerous to the whole planet.
There. Yeah. Well, I forget the name of the aquifer, but one of the biggest in the...
The Ogallala.
Ogallala, thank you. And just like the... wasn't that the name for one of the tribes of Dakota Indians?
Yeah.
Or Dakotas, or...
Yeah, the Ogallala is a tribal name.
Yeah, I thought so. I mean, I'm not saying...
Ogallala, Lakota...
One of the first books I ever got, one of my aunts got me a book when I was at 5 years old called The Real Book About Indians, and it might have been in a lot of ways not the real book, but it gave you a real insight into the different styles of life that the different groupings had, the the Longhouse Indians in the East, Algonquin, Iroquois, the Six Tribes. The ones you talked about. I believe you're talking about a Seminole chief that fought the Spanish.
Oh, no, no, no. That was not a Seminole chief. I mean, we don't even necessarily know properly what. But no, Tuscaloosa was, what, the 1500s? So it would be hard to say what he was.
Yeah. I was playing down at a fall job in Knoxville one year and met a lot of Native Americans who were gathering for something down there. And I talked on the bridge to them and got an idea of what. Because I'm not an expert, but compared with some people, you know, I do have learned a little here and there. But I'll let somebody else on here because I'm not, you know me, I only can get out and stir the pot. I can't.
You stir just fine, Bill. You stir just fine.
Well, believe me, there was a lot of people that thought I belonged there in France. Anyway.
You take care and have a good night, Bill.
You too, sir.
All right. I hope we talk soon. Bye now. Phil, Mr. Stress, legendary bluesman. Calling from Cleveland. Onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Howdy, Bob.
Howdy. Andy?
Is Boris Johnson, Bob?
Oh, Boris.
Boris Johnson from London, Bob.
Yar.
I just had an interview with some man that calls himself a journalist. Called Eddie Murray.
Did you now?
Eddie asked me some provocative questions about my past, Bob. Can you believe that?
Well, that's just dirty pool.
He called me a nasty, nasty man. Because I was, you know, Bob, I was fired from my job at the London Times.
Actually, I did know that.
I was making up quotes, Bob. Well, you know, if you don't have a quote, what are you going to do? You have to make them up. That's what a good Tory does. and also, they accused me of giving the addresses of federal reporters away to people that want to
hurt them.
Well, beat them up. You know, teach them a lesson. Unbelievable, Bob. Your Boris took a beating last week.
Yeah, I read the story, and I didn't get to hear it, but I did read about it.
Yeah, I think there might also be, there's some other things they got him for, too. There might be some philandering going on there, too. The guy's something else. But they say he's so used to being coddled by the press, you know, especially in London, and he's such a funny interview that he just doesn't get questioned very harshly anymore. And when this guy laid into him about his past.
Yeah, that one particular line, you're a nasty piece of work, aren't you?
Yeah, I think that it was something like that, exactly, paraphrasing. Nasty, nasty piece of work you are. Yeah, they let him have it. Hey, Jorge Bergoglio, I'm sending you some emails.
Yeah, saw that.
Oh, mercy. This is a bad scene in Argentina. Very bad.
Well, if there's any value in this, Andy, it will be that it will be revisited. And maybe the world will know a little bit more than it knew back then about the Argentine Dirty War. And if we know what Frank's involvement was with it, the better.
Right, the information's definitely out there, and you know, and Mark, the Marine from Florida, and I know Jim has commented on this as well. But man, those grandmothers. Don't get out there in the square with their pots and pans for decades trying to find out what happened to their children and their grandchildren for nothing. You know,
yeah.
30,000 people. That's a lot of there are parents and grandparents affected by that. 30,000 missing, right?
Yeah.
That's a big number.
And still not necessarily accounted for, right?
Right. Right. And 150 clergy, two cardinals, gone. And then...
Not just any clergy, though. It was the liberation theology clergy.
Right. Right. The ones that actually thought maybe the working class, you know, ought to have a means to not be poor, like in Venezuela. Like, get a little uplifted. You know, just from not being in staggeringly gripping poverty. Unbelievable. And I sent you that New York Times article, and they did a front pager, and one of those theology liberation priests actually pointed to Bergoglio, you know, as being a problem for them, as, you know, basically putting the finger on them when he expelled them from the Jesuit priesthood. And then they were picked up. And he claims that, you know, Mr. Frank sold them out, basically. So, you know, that guy's name, I think, was Father Europe.
Well, I think what it proves, Andy, is that the church can act with impunity and do most anything it wants to do. And it serves as a reminder of that because, for instance, isn't Cardinal Law, who would otherwise be under indictment in the United States, isn't he living in some nice little apartment in Rome after having covered up and facilitated the rape of God knows how many little boys?
I believe so. On the lam, where he's untouchable. And then the whole thing with the baby harvesting. God, that's horrifying stories. 500 babies were harvested, right? They take these left-wing women involved with trade groups, unions, or doing some kind of political organizing, harvest the babies, give them to some military family, put some drugs in the women, and send them on a flying expedition, you know, over the Rio de la Plata River or over the Atlantic, you know, in the nude, without any wings.
Or parachutes.
Right, or parachutes. And it's probably chained together with some other individuals that had their babies harvested, too. And it's estimated that 500 of those. I mean, it was brutal. And of course, you know, it's the same thing with the Catholic Church. It's just the same thing as the Nazi Holocaust. We know nothing, right?
Yeah.
We know nothing. I didn't know. Yet he would give communion to the Pink Panther. The guy who was...
And says now that he did that in an effort to, what, intercede on behalf of the priests who had been kidnapped? That's his claim, and he's sticking to it.
Right. But, man, that's a horrible situation there to be able to... And Videla, under oath, said that the Catholic Church collaborated with them. No, they were co-conspirators, and that's from the Pink Panther himself. And like I said to you as well, if anybody in the Horn family wants to find out information about, you know, what went on in Latin America during those early years, the 70s and 80s in the Reagan era, go to Robert Perry's consortiumnews.com.
Yeah, he's got
a great article.
Yeah.
There. And Robert Perry was there.
He was. Robert Perry is a real journalist.
That's why he's not a journalist anymore.
Right. I don't mean this to sound like name dropping. I got to meet him once, and he told me what it was like when he was covering Iran-Contra and basically breaking Iran-Contra and how he, you know, for his troubles got run.
Right, they didn't want that going out in that form, you know, as blisteringly truthful as he was. Yeah, he paid the price for that, no doubt about it. So yeah, I mean, really, it's the guy was made the Pope for a reason, And the reason is he's part of the network. You know, this guy can be trusted.
Yeah, and the fact that he also had a sense, Andy, that he was going to do good PR.
Absolutely.
And that business of washing the feet of some juvenile delinquents, and I don't even like that term, was exactly that. It was masterful PR.
Absolutely.
And the fact that he got the hardcore right wing of the church all up in arms, which necessarily painted him in a more positive light. You can't pay for that kind of story placement, because they did, Andy. They got seriously bent out of shape. He washed the foot of a woman, of a filthy, filthy, sin-infested woman. Jesus washed his disciples' feet. There ain't nothing in there about him washing some woman's feet, some nasty daughter of Eve. And so all the you know, the barbed wire wearing, self-flagellating hair shirt. You know the crowd, like, you know, like the bunch that in that church that Mel Gibson founded. They're positively apoplectic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, naturally, the for-profit media begins to, well, what's next? The ordination of women to the priesthood? No. This is just a shiny thing to throw out there for the for-profit media to go chase.
Right. He's a good smiley face to put out there. And that's why they know that he can play the role. I mean, if he got away with it in Argentina, under fire like that, to be able to keep the straight and narrow, you know, keep the junta happy.
Well, and Texas Betsy pointing out, she says, a rabbi here keeps pointing out how good Francis will be for the Jews.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Now, another thing I want to bring up, too, is that progressive budget that came out recently with 84 Democrats voting for it. Gee whiz, what a great piece of work that budget is. I mean, creating 7 million jobs compared to Obama's budget, which will lose about 750,000 jobs, is going to raise $4.2 trillion in revenue in 10 years. Obama's only raises $620 billion.
Right.
And here you had, you know, my representative didn't support it. She voted against it. Nancy Pelosi voted against it. There are a number of people you would have thought would be on the left that didn't go for it. I mean, this is really the way you smoke out who are the true progressive legislators. And it creates six tax brackets above the $250,000 income range. I mean, this budget is what gets us out of these deficits.
And you know when we've got a chance to get that budget, Andy? 2022 at the earliest.
Yeah.
I mean, I hate to keep coming back to that, but dadgummit, it's real. We are probably saddled with some manifestation of this level of lunacy in the House of Representatives for the next 9 years. Which, well, 10 years really, because that Congress will not take power until January of 2023. Now that's a decade.
Don't be so discouraging.
Well, no, I'm not trying to be discouraging. I'm trying to be realism guy, because unless something happens to change the gerrymandering, that's how long these districts are going to remain in place. And these districts were drawn specifically in order to create the situation that exists right now.
Yeah. Oh, man. It's just such a beautiful piece of work, that budget. The transaction tax that the nurses are pushing on Wall Street bring in, about $350 billion. And then you have the carried interest goes away. Getting rid of that loophole on capital gains for the hedge funds. Man, it's just awash.
I think that budget shows, Andy, that it is possible to solve this problem.
Right.
And if anything, I mean,
it's country in the world.
None of the people who were supporting that progressive budget expected it to pass. But they were trying to put something out there to show that there is another way.
Right.
And to show that there is a solution. But there's mindset stuff that has to change. I was looking at my Facebook page earlier today, and Faith put on there about having seen, I think it was Faith, about having seen a bumper sticker that had all kinds of military bumper stickers all over it, and then had one bumper sticker that said government is the problem.
Yeah. They're always going to be with us, Bob, the people that think like that. I mean, no question, they're always going to be there. You know.
Well, and in that case, you've either got to go over them, under them, or through them.
Right. Somehow we gotta get back the house. I mean, that's the bottom line. Somehow we gotta get that. You know, I saw a fun fact the other day in the New York Times. This was an article that was actually, a lot of times I don't get to read all the articles I want. I'm kind of an avid news hound, as you might guess. February 10th, New York Times was an article looking beyond income towards a tax on wealth itself, right?
Yeah.
It, out of all the OECD nations, we're third to last as far as 2010 revenue goes, collections with our taxes as a proportion of GDP. There are only two other countries in the industrialized world of the OECD nations that collect less tax revenue per GDP. And guess who they are?
Tell me.
It's Chile and Mexico. All right, they're the worst, the least amount of tax collections. We're third to last. I believe they're like 32 OECD nations. That would make us 30th in tax collections. I mean, that's the problem. The problem is we don't collect taxes the way we used to. And Bernie Sanders has said we're at the lowest tax collections to GDP that we've been in 60 years. It's pretty simple. They're starving the beast, man.
We're doing what they have said all along they intended to do.
Right. The kids are going to pay the price, and the infrastructure. Look at, you know, the college education thing. We're not funding colleges and education the way we're not funding the infrastructure.
Well, speaking of which, did you see that story coming out of Tennessee, Andy? This will send you screaming into the night. This right winger who has become a name for being a real lunatic. He must have ambitions of being in the House of Representatives. He's in the Tennessee State Legislature. He's from Knoxville, and his name is Stacy Campfield. Was a co-sponsor of a bill introduced in the legislature of Tennessee that would tie families' ability to receive what's called TANF, Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, to the children's grades in school.
Oh, jeez. Beautiful.
So if little Johnny misses a couple of spelling words and doesn't get a homework assignment in, little Johnny don't eat.
Right. That's good. Really penalize the family. Let's not look at the cause and effect of why maybe the kid's not doing well at school if he's